This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. And of course, the same time we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org. And today we're going to begin with the biggest story worldwide. COVID-19 is a respiratory disease that is spread from person to person. And while there is currently no vaccine available, hospital emergency departments are the front lines for people experiencing serious known symptoms. Today we have an excerpt from the Doctor Podcast with host Scott Webb in a discussion with Dr. Steve English, an emergency medicine doctor at Jamestown Regional Medical Center, about how COVID-19 is being handled at his hospital. We'll begin with Dr. English describing what he sees in his emergency department.
We haven't had any cases, thank goodness, but I'm sure that's going to change here in the near future. It's kind of difficult to know what to prepare for. We look out west and out east and see how these larger cities are getting a big surge of patients. And we're at this time preparing to see that surge. I don't expect that we'll see as big of a surge as a big city as we are able to social distance a little bit better here in North Dakota than, say, New York City. But I think we'll see a surge enough to maybe put a test on our capabilities of handling a number of patients and a number of severe critical patients. Right now, mostly what I'm seeing in the community is a lot of anxiety because of the unknown. We don't know how it's going to affect our community. We don't know how many people are going to get infected. And we don't know if we have enough staff to meet the surge that might be coming. We believe we do, and we're preparing as much as we can for that. But again, it's just the anxiety and the fear of the unknown. So we do see some people coming in to the emergency department saying we have all, or that they have all the signs and symptoms of COVID. And unfortunately, most of the signs and symptoms of COVID kind of imitate influenza. So most of these patients are coming in with influenza thinking they have COVID. COVID isn't a death sentence. It is very serious and we have to respect it. But if you have COVID, that doesn't necessarily constitute an emergency. It's the shortness of breath, problems breathing, chest pain or discomfort that would constitute that emergency.
Okay, well, it's good to know, and I'm glad to hear that you haven't had any cases yet, but that you guys are prepared. With respect to PPEs, how are you all doing and situated with masks and gloves and those types of things?
Right now, looking at our supply, I think we have enough. But if we should have a surge, I don't know. At Jamestown Regional Medical Center, we're preparing for the worst. So if we're preparing for the worst, we still probably do not have enough PPE. It's all the unknown at this point. We, again, don't know how many patients are going to be affected by this. We don't know how many medical providers, nurses, doctors, respiratory therapists, x-ray techs are going to come down with this to the fact where they may need to be quarantined or need to be out for a couple of weeks. So now we have new people coming in and also using the protective equipment. I will say that we appreciate anyone willing to donate unused N95s or regular surgical masks or even the industrial N95 masks, because again, we don't know and we definitely don't want to be in that position where the providers are short PPE. And it's not that we're trying to be selfish saying, hey, we need this PPE to keep us from being sick, so we don't go down with this and we're not handcuffed by this. But we're saying that we want this PPE so that we can remain healthy, so that we can help the patients that are coming in that need that critical care. Because there's no worse feeling in the world where you need the help and there's no one else there to provide that help that you need.
Real heroes on the front line need to be prepared. And I'm glad you mentioned that you're accepting donations of appropriate PPEs, that you just want to be prepared if and when, you know, the worst happens, you know, for your area. So let's just take a step back here and let's talk about who's at the highest risk for COVID-19. Because what I'm hearing is that a lot of the mortalities have as much to do, you know, with people who are in those high risk categories who also got COVID-19, that, you know, normally healthy people who get COVID-19 are probably not going to die from it. But who's at highest risk for COVID-19?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question. The people at higher risk are usually people over 55, 60 that have comorbidities. And when I say comorbidities, I mean health problems like diabetes, heart failure, hypertension or high blood pressure, coronary artery disease at high risk of heart attacks. Basic immunocompromise like diabetes would also constitute an immunocompromise, but people that have weakened immune systems would be at very high risk. I don't want to shortchange younger people like probably you and me that are also at a bit of a risk, where it's not uncommon to hear some of these young people out there that are still fighting for their lives on ventilators, needing help breathing. It's shown that this disease will cause something called acute respiratory distress syndrome, and it's severe inflammation of the lungs. And it makes it really difficult for even us to help you breathe because the lungs aren't working the way they're supposed to be. And also shows that it can cause inflammation of the heart, something called myocarditis. And that's inflammation of the muscle of the heart. And it's very serious. And there, unfortunately, really isn't any proven treatment for this yet. So young people that are going out thinking that they are immune to this or won't get severe symptoms, they very well could be wrong. I'm finding that the older generation is, and excuse my language for saying older generation, but they're really heeding the advice and staying inside. So if they do get the disease, obviously they're at higher risk, but I find that I think less of them are getting the disease because they're heeding that advice. The young people are going out thinking they're immune, and now more of them are getting that disease or getting COVID and spreading it and also getting the severe effects. As far as the very low risk, it would be children, especially under 9 or 10 years of age. They think that there's certain receptors on the child cells that aren't developed as much as the adults are. And that receptor is what the COVID-19 virus uses to get in and cause the infection. So they feel that the children are less risk. And that's not necessarily true with the immunocompromised child, but true for the healthy child. But then they can turn out to be super spreaders where they have the virus, they have the very minor symptoms. People think it's just a minor cold. And then they take them to see grandma and grandpa and then spread it to these more at-risk population.
That's all great information and great advice. And I'm just thinking about, you know, I've seen my mom a couple of times in the last week or so and not been able to hug her, you know. And you mentioned the anxiety earlier, and we're all staying home and we're all going a little stir crazy and we're maxing out our Netflix and we can't hug our relatives. My son has a birthday coming up and can't have a birthday party. And I saw this story online about the children now doing these drive-up birthday parties, right? So the kids stay down at the end of the driveway and grandma and grandpa come by and they throw a card out and they throw a present out. So speaking of drive-through, with respect to testing, is Jamestown Regional Medical Center doing drive-through testing yet? Has it come to that yet? Do you have any tests there available? How are patients being screened? So a lot to answer there, but basically when it comes to the tests, are you screening? How are you screening people? Is there drive-through testing available?
Yes, there's drive-through testing available at Sanford Health, and that's just across town from Jamestown Regional Medical Center. They are a separate entity, but we're trying to work together with both Sanford, Essentia Health, and us, JRMC. Sanford is doing the drive-up testing. And basically what they ask is to call ahead to see if there's tests available. Because unfortunately, although the CDC and the North Dakota Department of Health have these guidelines on testing, we are still short of tests. Believe me, we would love to test everyone that came in the door and asked for the test, but it's impossible due to the number of tests. You might look up on the CDC website and say, okay, I need all those criteria. I should get a test. It's very likely that you might not get tested at that point just due to the number of tests we have. And we're not trying to hinder you getting a test, but we want to try to save those tests for the most at-risk population. And especially when we get that surge, we will run out very, very, very quickly. So just call ahead. If you have questions, there's hotline numbers that are posted on social media, on JRMC's page, I'm sure on Sanford Health's page.
That's awesome that you guys in Sanford are working together. And I've heard that and done some other interviews and found that, you know, local hospitals, regional hospitals are working together more than ever to tackle COVID-19. And as you say, there are a limited number of tests, so people do have to be screened. Don't just show up. But great to know that there is drive-through testing available. Dr. English, wrapping up here today, what's your best advice for avoiding COVID-19, for staying healthy, whether that's mentally or physically?
First of all, I think that physical health is directly related to the mental health. And I wish I had the greatest answer of how to stay mentally healthy. For those that have the luxury of having the family right with you there, you know, please savor that time together, because kids going to school, you know, it kind of limits the time that parents have with their kids. So savor that time. I guess I've started meditation. I've never thought I'd ever meditate in my life. I would have laughed 3 weeks ago if you would have said that I would be meditating. But there's websites out there that kind of explain to you how to meditate and take that time for yourself to clear your mind and think of absolutely nothing. Take a rest from the news, take a rest from social media, and just be by yourself for 30 minutes a day. As much as you can, you know, get outside. And some people have the luxury of you know, kind of living in wide open spaces. Take advantage of that. Walk, run, take time to stop and smell the flowers. As far as staying healthy, I'm going to tell you the same thing that they say on TV, that they say on the radio, to wash your hands, cover your mouth with your elbow, the crease of your elbow when coughing or sneezing. If you have any of those symptoms, please stay inside. In fact, you should stay away from people as much as you can right now as we speak. Doesn't matter whether or not you think you have the virus or not. When you wash your hands, make sure you take your ring and your watch off, because that virus definitely can get underneath those things. And washing your hands with those things on, you're not going to get that virus off. It's tough not to hug or kiss your kids or your wife or your husband or whoever you may be kissing at this time or hugging at this time. But at this point, it's probably better not to be doing any of that. If you do have the virus, or you suspect that you have the virus and you're at home, try to social distance yourself from your family. You have that luxury to live in a different part of the house as they are. That would be the best.
Dr. English, thanks so much for your time today, your advice, your wisdom. I'm one of those people who likes to learn something every day if I can. And just the thing you mentioned there about taking your ring off, I have not been taking my ring off. I didn't think to do that. That is really amazing advice. Thank you so much for being on today.
Oh, thank you very much for having me and allowing me to discuss our concerns with the community.
That's Dr. Steve English, an emergency medicine doctor at Jamestown Regional Medical Center. For the latest on COVID-19 and how JRMC can help, visit jrmcnd.com. We hope you found this podcast helpful. I'm Scott Webb. Thanks for listening.
Next on Main Street, Tom Ezern with a Plains Folk essay.
Things are quieter than usual here in our newsroom, but not because there's any less news to cover. Our staff is dispersed. Many of us are working from home to bring you Morning Edition, so we understand that loneliness and social isolation are very real concerns. But we will be right here to keep you informed and to keep you company. We're not going anywhere. Stay connected with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Morning Edition, weekdays beginning at 4 a.m. Central, 3 Mountain on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history at NDSU. As his blurb on Amazon.com says, he has devoted his work to the study of history and life on the Great Plains of North America as an author, teacher, historian, folklorist, singer, public speaker, radio personality, and heavy reader. He's the voice of the Plains Folk essays we feature on Main Street, and today's piece is titled Pioneers of the Box Social.
The Jamestown Weekly Alert declared it the social event of the week. The basket social hosted by the ladies of the Methodist Episcopal Church, using a vacant business space as venue in late September 1884. The hosts made the room ready and attractive, and before the arrival of guests, it was graced by an abundance of handsomely constructed baskets well filled with the delicacies of the season from all parts of the continent, as the alert described them, each basket containing supper for two, which the gallant gentlemen present purchased at good prices and divided the contents with some lady of the assemblage, leaving her with the basket as a souvenir of the feast. Mr. I.C. Wade was pressed into service as auctioneer for the occasion, we are told, and succeeded in disposing of the baskets at boom prices, notwithstanding the financial depression of the times, the prices ranging from 50 cents to $3, the general average being about $2, and the aggregate receipts for the evening amounting to about $40. The editor names all the ladies in charge of arrangements and then adds the local color. it seems one of the ladies had packed a splendid supper into the bottom of a large cheese box, wonderfully decorated, and then, on top of the supper, packed a heap of raw turnips, beets, cabbage, and rutabagas. The purchaser, Mr. E.S. Miller, was dismayed on first opening the box, but still, the editor recounts, after lifting out a small cargo of these uncooked productions of the James River Valley, he came upon the best basket of delicacies in the evening, and expressed delight both with the supper and with the prank. The affair concluded to universal satisfaction at 11 p.m. The passages I just quoted are intriguing in two respects. First, the language indicates a need to describe and explain the event, evidence that the basket social, also known as the box social, a commonplace of American folkways in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, was not yet a commonplace in Dakota Territory. The ladies of Jamestown were pioneers. Theirs was not the first box social in Dakota Territory. I have found accounts of some as early as 1883, none before that. But the box social clearly was new to the Jamestown scene. Someone there had experience with it back east, or heard of it, and decided to introduce the custom to the Jim River Valley. In addition, the affair was non-standard as to a key accepted element of basket socials across the country. It lacked the flavor of, shall we say, flirtation or romance, possible true love. The scheme commonly was for the ladies to prepare baskets, artfully ornamented and thoughtfully filled, but unidentified as to preparer. Then the men bid on the baskets, supposedly without knowledge of whose was whose, and then dined with the packer of the basket, who disclosed her identity only after conclusion of the auction. Perhaps this was a little too risque for the Methodist ladies to countenance. 50 years ago, I played in the Pitt Orchestra for a community theater production of Rodgers and Hammerstein's Oklahoma. You may not remember, but I certainly do, that the box supper is a significant plot device in that Broadway musical. Our handsome hero, Curly, rents a fancy rig and invites the lovely Lori to ride in style with him to the box social. She declines. At the social, the bidding for Lori's box between Curly and his rival, Judd, introduces deadly conflict to the story. Rodgers and Hammerstein reckoned that the box social would connote Americana to audiences, and they were right. It turns out that Dakota Territory, too, was a hotbed of box suppers, some of them enlivened by hijinks, although no known fatalities. Bidding commences in my next column.
That's Tom Ezern. Coming up, poetry from Studio 47.
Uh-oh, the kids are stuck home? Well, there is some help. Prairie Public reminds you about PBS Kids. It's on the television, but there's also pbskids.org, where you can find all kinds of educational and fun games and activities. pbskids.org or PBS Kids on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. Thanks for joining us today. Poetry from Studio 47 comes to us from Patrick Hicks, writer-in-residence and a member of the English faculty at Augustana University in Sioux Falls. And today, his poetry in Studio 47 profiles Eleanor Wilner.
Wilner was born in Cleveland, Ohio, on July 29, 1937. She went to Goucher College, where she earned her BA in 1959. She then went to Johns Hopkins University, where she received her PhD. Wilner has been active in the civil rights movement, the peace movement, and much of her work focuses on what she calls cultural memory. That is, she avoids writing overtly personal poems and favors, instead, poems that speak about moments in our collective past. She often uses mythology and history to create her art. A former editor of American Poetry Review, she once described the poetic culture of North America as vibrant and wonderfully chaotic. More specifically, she said, "We are a chorus without a leader, and we pick up our themes and images from every side and from bristling at and listening to one another. It is this eclectic, imaginative miscegenation that makes our poetry so unclassifiable, so inexhaustible, and happily, so entirely unpredictable. Not surprisingly, she has written many books over her long career, including Gathering the Winds, Sarah's Choice, Otherwise, Reversing the Spell, The Girl with Bees in Her Hair, and Tourist in Hell, which focuses on the ferocious violence of the 20th and 21st centuries. Wilner has won a fellowship from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Robert Frost Medal, as well as a fellowship from the MacArthur Foundation, often referred to as a genius grant. She has taught at the University of Chicago, Northwestern University, and she is currently a professor on the MFA program at Warren Wilson College. She lives in Philadelphia. Today's poem is High Noon at Los Alamos. Even though the title of the poem tells us that it's set in Los Alamos, New Mexico, the chronology of this poem goes back much further than that. In fact, we are brought back to the time of the dinosaurs, to those terrible lizards that once ruled the planet. Wilner wants us to consider that moment when a gigantic meteorite, perhaps one the size of a skyscraper, came roaring from the heavens in blinding fury. This flash of light, this fist of apocalyptic energy, obliterated forms of life that had existed on our planet for millions of years. When the shockwaves finally calmed and the smothering ash clouds rolled away, a new species, us, would eventually appear. In time, we would become the ruling species, which brings me back to the title of the poem. It takes place in Los Alamos. Why does that matter, you might ask? Well, Los Alamos is where the Americans invented the world's very first atomic bomb. It was here, under a program called the Manhattan Project, which was a government operation so secret that even Vice President Harry Truman didn't know about it, that scientists under the direction of Robert Oppenheimer unleashed fire in a way that they had never seen before. Wilner wants us to consider how we as a species yearn to capture fire, how we have used it for warfare, from the time of the Greeks until that time when two miniature suns were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Our quest for fire might very well be our undoing. Perhaps, Wilner suggests, fire will come from the sky once again to pare us down. This is High Noon at Los Alamos by Eleanor Wilner. To turn a stone with its white squirming underneath, to pry the disk from the sun's eclipse, white heat coiling in the blinded eye, to these malign necessities we come from the dim time of dinosaurs who crawled like breathing lava from the earth's cracked crust and swung their tiny heads above the lumbering tons of flesh, brains no bigger than a fist, clenched to resist the white flash in the sky the day the sun flares pared them down to relics for museums, turned glaciers back, seared cyanized meadows black, the ferns withered, the swamps were melted down to molten mud, the cells uncoupled, recombined, and madly multiplied, huge trees toppled to the ground, the slow life there abandoned hope, a caterpillar stiffened in the grass. Two apes, caught in the act of coupling, made a mutant child, who woke up to sunlight wondering, his mother torn by the huge new head that forced the narrow birth canal. As if compelled to repetition and to unearth again, white fire at the heart of matter, fire we sought and fire we spoke, our thoughts, however elegant, were fire from first to last, like centuries set to watch at Argos for the signal fire, past peak to peak, from Troy to Nagasaki, triumphant echo of the burning city walls and prologue to the murders yet to come. We scanned the sky for that bright flash, our eyes stared white from watching, for the signal fire that ends the epic, a cursed line with its caesura, a pause to signal peace, or a rehearsal for the silence.
Patrick Hicks, reading High Noon at Los Alamos, from poet Eleanor Wilner. Poetry from Studio 47 is recorded at Augustana University and is produced by Peter Folliard. Coming up on Main Street, our weekly news roundup from Dave Thompson and a chat with our film reviewer, Matt Olin, about movies to watch while sheltering in place. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
The danger is still here. The numbers, and I want to make sure I tell everyone this, the peak will come to Minnesota. We are still early out. You have made it possible to push it out further, which has gained valuable time.
1 week into his shelter-in-place order, Minnesota Governor Tim Walz says social distancing is working in the state. Walz says by keeping to social distancing protocol, the rate of infections has slowed in Minnesota and is saving lives. Walz says the danger is still here, but he adds the past week has helped push back the peak date for COVID-19, giving the state valuable time.
There are things that the virus will do, and there's a science that shows us where it's happening, but the science is also on our side of finding things we can do against it. The ability to think coherently, to think together, and to move against this is one of the advantages that we have.
Walz says by developing smart strategies, we can quickly and safely move back to conducting economic activity that matters to us. The North Dakota School Superintendent Kirsten Basler says distance learning plans have been now approved for 171 public school districts and 39 private schools in the state. A handful of districts submitted joint plans. Governor Burgum closed school buildings last month to help slow the spread of COVID-19. Basler says there is still plenty of work to do.
Planning the wedding is hard. Living in a marriage is the work. And so that's what we're into right now is the implementation of what our plans were. And there will be bumps. And I think it's okay that we acknowledge that. I think our students will expect that we acknowledge that. I know that our parents are experiencing some bumps.
Basler says the CARES Act contains $13.5 billion for elementary and secondary education. North Dakota's share of the pie is expected to be around $33 million. Basler says those dollars will be distributed using a Title I formula.
The U.S. Education Department has informed DPI that they intend to release an application within the next few weeks for us to apply for these funds. DPI is simultaneously working on an application and guidance and will disseminate these applications and information to our LEAs, to our school districts later this month.
Basler says there may be a quick turnaround for spending the money with an anticipated deadline of September 30th. And another casualty of COVID-19 is the All True Hospital project in Grand Forks. The health system is putting further construction on hold to prioritize the operational resources on the coronavirus pandemic. The All True Board of Directors and executive team said they were making the adjustment to ensure we can provide care to all patients during this unprecedented time. All True President Dr. Stephen Weiser added that, quote, "We don't know exactly how COVID-19 will impact our community, only that it will." All True broke ground on the new hospital in June 2019. The original seven-story building was projected to cost $305 million. The project was later scaled back to five floors before a sixth floor was added back into the mix. All True says construction will resume when deemed appropriate. Weiser said we will have a new hospital. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Well, that teletype in the background means it's time for us to talk with our news director, Dave Thompson, about the week's big stories. And Dave, most of them have had the same theme, COVID-19.
You can say the week's big and almost ubiquitous story, perhaps.
Yeah, for the year, as a matter of fact. You had a story that you filed this morning. Attorney General Wayne Stendrum says scammers are out there to take advantage of the pandemic. That's pretty ugly.
And, of course, they're preying on people who are probably socially distancing themselves, are at home alone, probably devoid of human contact, might be a little bit vulnerable. So they're talking to him about a couple of things. And the one thing that's coming out now is that's based on this $1,200 we're all supposed to be getting from the federal government. Scammers are calling and basically telling these people, hey, if you pay us so much money, we'll get it to you faster. We'll make sure it's right. And then people are being sucked into this and they're paying some money when they don't have to.
And one of these involves a promotion that we know very well. We've heard it for many years, Publishers Clearinghouse.
That's right. And this is where they basically said, you get a call. Here is the number, you know, got a special secret number that you're supposed to, you know, enter in. Then you call back, enter the number in. Then you're charged to make sure that you get the money. And it's interesting, a woman was bilked out of more than $9,000 in North Dakota. She was getting ready to make a second payment, and then she found out that this was a scam, so she called the Attorney General's office to tell them about it. The AG's office called the Texas sheriff, where the address was, where she sent the check. The sheriff actually went out, got the envelope before the check was cashed, so she's not out the $9,000, which is a good news story for what could be a very serious situation.
Nice to hear a happy ending. Yes. Also today, you mentioned that Governor Burgum says we don't have a statewide stay-in-place order. We don't have a lockdown like lots of states do, most states, as a matter of fact. And he says if we follow the guidelines, we won't need one, right?
That's right. He said if you follow the social distancing guidelines, the 6 foot, and keep your social gatherings to 10 people or less, as long as you've got that 6 foot distance between you, and you only travel if you go need to get groceries or something like prescription drugs, then he thinks we're going to be okay. We're going to survive this very well. Now, it's interesting because if you look at some of his guidance in terms of that, a lot of states that said we do have lockdown on place, well, there are exceptions too. So the only thing that's really, I think, the difference between, say, North Dakota and Minnesota is that Minnesota actually has more oomph of the law behind it. If you violate something in North Dakota, for example, if you're a bar and that's open and you're not supposed to be open, it's an infraction. In Minnesota, it's a misdemeanor, which is a stronger penalty.
And there was an incident of a bar in North Dakota that has been open and skirting the guidelines by offering drinks for a donation. and that bartender, he's in trouble.
He's in trouble. He's done it 5 times, from what I understand. And he is facing some potential charges. And even at the idea that you're going to just be an infraction, could be $1,000 a pop. So that could be a real difficult thing. Now, that bar owner has said that he thinks this whole thing is a hoax, which I thought was interesting.
Well, there's also, as it turns out, the chair and professor of the Department of Sociology at Minnesota State Moorhead has been circulating a graph, a statistical breakdown that she's done comparing Minnesota and North Dakota's outbreaks and the difference in terms of lockdowns or whatever. And the confirmed cases per 10,000 people in North Dakota are significantly higher than in Minnesota, even though the population density is way, way less. So I think the numbers crunchers might argue with the governor a little bit.
They might at that point. But it is very interesting. And of course, the truism is that the viruses respect no borders. So they're going to affect every state, every local municipality. They're going to be affecting everything. So I guess the governor is going to be weighing about, you know, can we do social distancing? Can we keep a handle on it just doing that?
Well, in the meantime, we've got a lot of people who are out of work. I think unemployment statistics are unbelievably high for the state historically. And the governor wants to get some relief as quickly as he can, right?
Right. He's basically waiving any waiting that you might have to do if you file for unemployment. You'll get unemployment benefits faster. It's been normally a 2-week waiting period. Now that's waived and you can get that within a day or two. That helps people, and especially if you are in one of those jobs where you're furloughed or something like that, that will help a lot. I found it interesting, Doug, that figures from the last basic month are more in terms of unemployment filings than all of 2019.
Wow.
So you're talking about 1 month versus 12 months. So this is a very serious situation. And you have it in the energy industry and the hospitality industry, which are hit pretty hard.
Well, the oil patch, of course, is the energy industry largely in North Dakota. And there is a little bit of good news here. Mm-hmm. Saudi Arabia and Russia are apparently getting ready to talk next week about the, you know, flooding of the market with cheap crude, which has really shut down shale operations.
Right. And that's already affected the price. The price seems to be going back up. I was talking with an analyst today, and they were expecting prices to drop into the teens. But now it's about $26, $27 a barrel at last report and might go up a little bit further. People are a little bit more confident that something might happen. Yet there's a lot of speculation, and we talked to Ernie Goss from Creighton University, who does the Mid-American Business Conditions Index. He is saying that this is those two countries' effort to completely shut down shale plays in the U.S.
Yeah, well, it's had a big impact on North Dakota and West Texas. I know that.
It sure has.
You had a story earlier this week that the governor has been talking about hand sanitizers, basically using resources within the state to create the product.
You have distillers in North Dakota who are, you know, making alcoholic products, and alcohol is a main component of a lot of these hand sanitizers. So he said some of these companies have stepped up and said we're willing to make the hand sanitizers. The trouble is they can't get the plastic, you know, the plastic containers, and they don't have a facility to fill the plastic containers. So what they're asking people to do is, hey, you're using hand sanitizer, save your plastic containers. We're going to come up with a way to actually refill your hand sanitizer from these homemade things, which probably are very good.
Okay. And there's another side effect of this that is really interesting. You had this report earlier today as well, that the governor has been talking about people need to quit smoking or quit vaping because this is a, you know, respiratory disease.
Yeah.
And apparently it's working.
Yes. Tobacco-Free North Dakota, you know, the quit line, has gotten a lot more hits since the governor started talking about it. And really, he's been talking about it every couple of briefings since he started the daily briefings about COVID-19. And he is saying, hey, it's a good time to quit because COVID attacks your respiratory system. And this is a good way to help prevent that from doing further damage.
Well, the calls to that Tobacco-Free North Dakota hotline have almost doubled in the last 2 weeks.
So. Right, and this could be that way as the COVID continues to grow in North Dakota.
Well, as we know, everybody's at home. That doesn't have to be in an essential work or job, and that means lots of school kids. And the largest school district in the state of North Dakota, Bismarck, is experiencing distance learning, right?
Everybody's experiencing distance learning now because all the school districts in North Dakota have had their plans okayed, and some districts are actually combining resources to provide it. But this is something new for everybody, so there's going to be some hiccups along the way. Superintendent Basler has said that they're kind of rolling this out, and there's going to be a problem here or there. They're going to try to get It's going to take some time to get your footing behind you when you start doing everything online, and everything's going to be tailored to making it simple and understandable to your grade level. There's a lot of work that's gone into this because when the governor said shut the schools and we're going to come back with distance learning, there was a lot of work that was being done. Bismarck did an awful lot of work. They had meetings. They had a lot of things that they had to get used to that they'd never gotten used to before. For example, using virtual meetings, which we all know about, whether it be Zoom or one of the other providers. And they've had to learn to do that. And he said, the superintendent was interesting. He said, for an extrovert, it's really hard to do these not in-person meetings.
Well, nevertheless, this is a teaching tool that will have lasting benefits. I mean, we've talked about online learning for a very long time, but this sort of forced focus on it will likely have benefits that will resonate past the pandemic.
That's correct. And you see the colleges are really embraced it. The colleges are closed for the remainder of the semester. No questions asked. No graduation ceremonies. As a matter of fact, I think UND has canceled its summer on campus offerings and has gone completely online. So there's a real concern and a real move toward trying to exploit technology as much as you can.
Well, let's end with kind of a nice story about a very difficult issue. The hospitality industry has been absolutely hammered by this. You had a story about a Bismarck real estate agent who has bought restaurant gift cards to help during the lockdown, and not just a little bit, a lot.
$15,000 worth of the gift cards. The gift cards will be given out when people close on properties, but the restaurants who are benefiting from this get the cash infused now, so it does help.
That's Cam Knutson, a Bismarck real estate agent, and our hats off
to him. Absolutely.
We check in with our news director, Dave Thompson, every week. Always a pleasure, Dave.
Good to talk to you, Doug.
The coronavirus pandemic isn't funny, but psychologist Lori Day says it's fine to crack a dark joke. She started a Facebook page dedicated to virus humor.
There are people in the group that are COVID positive, and they're literally laughing from their beds or their hospital rooms.
Our conversation and the latest on the virus and the economy, Saturday and Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
It's time to go to the movies with Matt Olean, and in a time of social distancing, that means checking your personal movie library or maybe downloading a movie to stream on your television or your laptop or your mobile device. Lots of ways to watch things these days. Matt, you have a huge personal collection, and today we're going to talk about movies from the past decade that you'd recommend for those of us who are shut in and restless.
Yeah, it was a great decade for movies, Doug, and who knows when you and I will do another actual first-run film review. I'm not sure, no one's sure, but I can't wait for that to happen because it's obviously going through some withdrawals, as Emma and Portrait of a Lady on Fire were the last films I reviewed. But within the last decade, let's maybe start with more kid-friendly films. I really loved Zootopia. I think that was my favorite Pixar animation of the last decade, Doug. It kind of was a film noir with this rabbit investigating things, and it was so good, so well done. Jennifer Goodwin did the voice of the rabbit. The sloth scene is something people talk about, but it was so inventive. That's probably my favorite animated film of the last 10 years. You know, for Marvel films, let's just face it, the Avengers films worked for me. From the first one in 2012 with the grouping of all of the big superheroes to the final Infinity War and Endgame, I know it's not everybody's cup of tea, but I think they checked all the boxes in terms of emotion, Captain America's story arc, Iron Man's story arc, Black Widow, and I think they're some of the better action films of the last 10 years. And as I've always said, I don't know why action films can't be on par with art films or dramas or things like that. For what they were, the Russo brothers really delivered on those Avengers films. Social Network, 2010. That was probably my first great film of the decade, 10 years ago now. Of course, Jesse Eisenberg as Mark Zuckerberg. I think that film still holds up very well. It's so entertaining, so interesting to see how Facebook was formed, his conflicts with some of his co-owners of Facebook and that whole thing. I really like Social Network a lot. Going to 2011, The Artist, which won Best Picture that year. Of course, that was a silent film, Doug. I still think that holds up very well. 12 Years a Slave in 2013, another good choice by the Oscar people for that, for Best Picture. One of the best slavery films I've still ever seen, Chiwetel Ejiofor, I thought should have got the Oscar. And there are still people I run into that have not seen that movie. That's one I would highly recommend. Some others more recently, you know, within the last year, Doug, as I said to you, there were three great films made last year. Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which is now kind of on pay cable, on demand. You can see that. I think it's Tarantino's best film since Pulp Fiction.
I just watched it.
What'd you think?
I thought it really is a good movie. It's well done.
It is. You can't stop watching it, can you?
It reminds me of that time, and it does have all these hooks in it because it's got these historical references and, of course, a lot of great acting as well.
And how about that star pairing, Doug, of DiCaprio and Pitt? It reminded me of Newman and Redford in Butch and the Sting. Just very rarely do you see two superstars like that paired together with such on-screen chemistry. And, of course, the final 30 minutes, we're not going to reveal it. But as you know, Tarantino likes to rewrite history. And, of course, the Manson family and all that comes up. And all I can say is buckle up for that last half hour.
What about a family movie, Matt?
Well, Zootopia, of course, as I mentioned. I think Grand Budapest Hotel by Wes Anderson is a very funny film that most people will enjoy. And I'm not saying little itty-bitty kids, but it's certainly an interesting film, I think, for the family to watch. You know, Eighth Grade, if your young teen is okay to watch that film, I still think that is about one of the best teenage movies I've ever seen. It came out in 2018 with Elsie Fisher. You want to kind of maybe talk to your teen and see if they're ready for a film like that.
It's pretty adult.
Yeah, it is pretty adult, yeah.
How about a great adventure flick? You know, the Avengers are that sort of comic book adventure, but how about, you know, a classic adventure flick?
I really like Dunkirk in 2017. If you're looking for a good history lesson, I think that film, you know, with kind of that multiple angles, multiple plot lines of Dunkirk going on, I think that checked the box pretty well. You know, some others, maybe not really adventure films, but all of the Marvel films I think are pretty good, Doug. I think they all came off pretty well. So if people didn't see all the Marvel films, maybe that's a good idea. Start from the beginning with Iron Man and see how many you can get through. They're all on Disney Plus. They are right there on Disney Plus. If you've got Disney Plus, that's where I would access those.
What if we want to laugh, Matt? What if we want to have a good time and be amused?
I think Nebraska's funny. It's a great film, black and white, and it's funny. And you and I, Doug, talked about Nebraska when it came out, the Alexander Payne movie with Bruce Dern, as he goes to kind of collect this lottery ticket that he thinks he's won. There are so many scenes that remind me of growing up in the Midwest. That scene with all the old men in that room and none of them are saying anything. I remember those settings very well, kind of that stoic Midwest Scandinavian man thing. And I think it's a very funny film. It's a very good film, but that's a very funny film. Zootopia is funny. I mentioned Zootopia. Zootopia is not only a good kids film, it's very funny as well.
I think the Grand Budapest Hotel is about as whimsically amusing as anything I've seen in a while.
Yeah, it's one of Wes Anderson's best films. Moonrise Kingdom is good, also by Wes, which came out this decade. But I think Grand Budapest Hotel is really kind of a culmination of a lot of Wes Anderson films. It's got all of his kind of stock characters in there. It's funny. The set design is great. You know, Willem Dafoe's in it, Ralph Fiennes, all these people. So that is one certainly that is very funny. And let's just say, too, Doug, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is funny. There are some hilarious scenes. When that little girl shows up, Julia Butters, who does the scene with DiCaprio, she is so good in that scene. She just walks off with that scene. I don't usually like names like Pumpkin Puss, but I can tell you're upset, so we'll talk about it later. She's so good in that scene. So a lot of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is funny. The Bruce Lee scene is well done as well. When Brad Pitt and Bruce Lee kind of face off on the set of Green Hornet, that's great too. If you want more serious movies, you know, 1917, of course, last year, Doug, about World War I. That's a great film. Boyhood. If people didn't see Boyhood, that film was shot over 12 years by Richard Linklater. That's a great one. The Master. The Master didn't make a lot of money when it came out in 2012. That's the film with Philip Seymour Hoffman, kind of as L. Ron Hubbard. I still think it's a marvelous movie. A few others. Midnight in Paris. You know, if you want a good laugh, that is probably Woody Allen's last, you know, I would say really close to great film, Midnight in Paris with Owen Wilson.
Well, how about La La Land? We get a little music in this.
I really liked La La Land. You know, there was some backlash against that film with people saying it was misogynistic and racist because it was about a white jazz musician. But to me, it was what it was. It was a film about a white jazz musician played by Ryan Gosling. Of course, Emma Stone is great in it. It's funny. It's whimsical. I think the dance numbers come off very well. And Moonlight, which it lost to for Best Picture that year. If you want something really gritty that's going to take you down into a different kind of life you've never seen, I think Moonlight still holds up, and I think that's a film that certainly deserved the Best Picture Oscar.
How about a really adult film like Blue is the Warmest Color?
Yeah, if you want to, if you don't have kids, if the kids are out of the house and you want to watch a good foreign film, it's about 3 hours long. It's a French movie, but I really liked it. It's one of the best foreign films I've seen all year. The Great Beauty from Italy, 2013. That's another film directed by Paolo Sorrentino. That's a really interesting film with phenomenal visuals, very, very foreign feel to it. Never Look Away, Doug. I think that's a film you'd like a lot if you didn't see it in 2018 that came out of Germany. It's about a young artist in East Germany after the war. And, you know, he's an artist that has a lot to say, doesn't really want to do the East German style painting. But it's a long film, but it's very interesting. Kind of deals with some of the people that were members of the Nazi Party that were still hanging around East and West Germany in the 50s and 60s. That's a really good film I like as well. It's a foreign movie.
Well, there's an awful lot of stuff out there to see. You were just talking about the last 10 years or so. So if you're looking to stream something, it's largely available online. You just got to go look for it. And these days, we're going to the movies at home. So, Matt Olien, it's always a pleasure to check in with you.
Thanks, Doug, and I'm so glad you liked Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
We've been to the movies with Matt Olien.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
Grant, this week I put on my flippers and mask and took a deep dive into one of our favorite books.
The dictionary?
Oh, close, but no tomato.
no one knew what the heck I was saying. No one had heard of it before at all. I would just get blank stares or questioning looks.
Sometimes a big debate breaks out.
Join us this week on Away With Words.
It's a good one.
That's Away With Words, Saturday at 9 Central, 8 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for April 3rd. Tomorrow is the anniversary of North Dakota's first commercial television station. It was 1953, and that first year, Minot's KCJB, now KXMC, chartered a plane to fly in from Minneapolis film coverage of each day of the World Series. But most of the shows were live programs by local teachers, ministers, county agents, and actors. The first woman on the air was Sis Hadley, who produced a regular show about style and fashion. She soon learned that live shows weren't without problems. Once, when doing a live commercial with fashion models, an oblivious new janitor walked between her and the camera with his broom and wastebasket. Another time, she was directing a style show during which she had to use headphones, and when the cameraman abruptly pulled back to do a wide shot, Miss Hadley's head went with him, followed by the sound of her hitting the floor. When the station first went on the air, a Minneapolis Tribune reporter covered the story. He was there during a live production of Arv's Kitchen. Arv Johnson and Harry Burris demonstrated how to drill holes in potatoes with an apple corer, stuff the cavities with cheese, and bake. Soon, viewers began to call, asking why their picture was suddenly foggy. Turns out the cheese had melted, run out of the potatoes, and started to burn. As smoke overtook the tiny studio, sports announcer Jim Adelson threw a pair of leather gloves across the room to Arv, who was trying to yank the potatoes out of the oven. Moments later, a man from West Hope called to say, "Tell Arv that he put 6 potatoes in there, but he only took out 5. There's still one in there burning." Choking from smoke and laughter, the Tribune reporter said he had to leave the room. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Mary Helm. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
You can purchase a book of Dakota Datebooks at shopprairiepublic.org.
Monday on Main Street, we'll continue our focus on the COVID-19 pandemic with our first in a series of interactive town halls. Our first will feature the impact of the health emergency on North Dakota's agricultural economy. Our featured guests will be Doug Goring, State Ag Commissioner, and Betty Grandy, USDA Rural Development Deputy Undersecretary. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Monday, and we hope you'll check out Main Street Weekend this Sunday morning at 10 Central. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.